This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There were many firsts for the United States during World War II, but the formation of the first International Foreign Intelligence Collection Service may be one of the most important. The precursor to the CIA, that was known as the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, ran covert operations in Europe and used espionage and saboteur tactics to advance the Allies' mission. Bill Donovan built the OSS, and he greatly influenced four future CIA directors who worked under him: Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, William Colby, and William Casey. They all played key roles in the intelligence war waged during World War II and then worked their way up the CIA ladder. But notorious missteps in their terms as CIA directors complicate their legacies. Doug Waller is the author of Disciples, the World War II missions of the CIA directors who fought for Wild Bill Donovan. Doug lives in Raleigh, and he joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
These are five big characters, Wild Bill Donovan. We really need to start with Bill Donovan. You wrote a book on him as well, and kind of who he was, and a little bit about the OSS that he later formed.
Yeah, Donovan was the subject of my previous biography, and he was really a larger-than-life figure. I mean, Hollywood couldn't have painted a better character. He grew up in Buffalo, New York, in the poor Irish First Ward of Buffalo. Went to Columbia University, quarterbacked his football team until a cheap tackle from a Princeton lineman hobbled him his senior year. Went to law school. Franklin Roosevelt was in his class in law school, although the two didn't mingle all that much. Rose up in Buffalo Republican politics. He was a Republican. In 1932, he ran for governor of New York. His idea then was to be the first Irish Catholic president of the United States, and New York was the ideal stepping stone. Franklin Roosevelt, 1932, was running for president, who had been governor of New York. Donovan was running against Roosevelt's lieutenant governor, a guy named Herbert Lehman. Ended up saying as many nasty things about Roosevelt as he did about Lehman. Roosevelt, for his part, had Eleanor and other surrogates on the trail rough up Donovan. The reason this backstory is interesting is because fast forward to 1940-41, Franklin Roosevelt's building the nation up for war. He can see a war on the horizon, and he needs to prepare the defenses. Donovan, even though he was a conservative Republican, he thought Roosevelt's New Deal was a right-wing plot to take over America. Was nevertheless part of the internationalist wing of the Republican Party. He, too, believed that the nation should build itself up for war. So you had two very canny politicians here who had fought in New York politics who saw common cause. July 1941, Roosevelt signs a very vaguely worded executive order making Donovan his coordinator of information. It would be later called the OSS. And from that, Donovan, really starting out with just one guy himself, built up a force of over 10,000 spies, saboteurs, propagandists, analysts, and support personnel scattered in stations all over the war during the war. A remarkable achievement considering he started out really with one guy.
Well, yeah, okay, a rough and tough politician. I grew up in Buffalo. We called where he came from the ward, and everybody right. knew what that meant. So if he came out of the ward, we know he's a great politician, or at least, and certainly accustomed to rough and tumble politics. What qualifies him as an intelligence officer?
He used to say that his men and women in the OSS were glorious amateurs, and they were, and so was he. He went on some private diplomatic missions for Roosevelt before the war to kind of assess things in England, in the Balkan states, and in Europe. But he really learned it on the job, and in fact, his entire OSS learned it on the job. He recruited from the best and brightest of American society. But very few, if any of them, had any foreign intelligence training. Keep in mind, before we got into that war, Roosevelt had no foreign intelligence service to speak of. I mean, there were tiny foreign intelligence units in the Army and the Navy, but they were largely dumping grounds for poor-performing officers. Mm-hmm. In fact, Roosevelt became so worried about what he didn't know overseas in 40, going into 41, when he's making momentous foreign policy decisions, that it would make him physically ill at times.
Wow. So there is no template. They make it up as they go along. Donovan goes from a staff of one, as you say, to a network of 10,000. How does he do that? How does he go about doing that?
In some ways, he was like a player in a pickup basketball game, looking for agents and operations anywhere he could. So, for example, Pan Am Airways. We've probably all flown at one time on Pan American Airways. Donovan hatched a secret agreement with Pan Am that its ticket takers in Africa would feed him intelligence on the movement of Gestapo and Abwehr agents on that continent. The Kodak cameras, they're bankrupt now, but in my day, they made the little brownie cameras. Sure. Back then, they had thousands of camera clubs all around the country. Donovan arranged with those camera clubs to send him photos that tourists had taken overseas in Europe and occupied countries of possibly militarily important sites. So in the beginning, it was kind of grab as you could until he could eventually start training agents. The British helped him out a good bit of the training and actually form a credible intelligence force. And he had to do it hurry up on the fly.
Yeah, and it's incredible. And in your first book, when you talk about his career, there's more of this. But just what you do with it. Okay, it's one thing to cleverly figure out who's on the front lines right now. Let's just employ them. Now you've got the information. Who's going to analyze this? Because really, as you say, there is no National Intelligence Service.
There isn't. And the four characters in my next book, Disciples, are really examples of this kind of come at you are party. I mean, you had Alan Dulles, who actually had some spy training on the job in World War I as a diplomat in Bern, Switzerland. He kind of learned it on his own. Richard Helms was actually perfectly happy being in the United States Navy tracking German Wolfpack submarines when he got yanked out of there and sent to Washington to serve in the OSS. Bill Colby just wanted to get in the action and fight somewhere, and he was a paratrooper stuck at Camp McCall, North Carolina, when he answered a phone number on a bulletin board, said, if you're interested in adventure and you speak French, and he spoke French, call this number, and it was an OSS number, and the next thing he knew, he was training to go parachute into Europe. Bill Casey was a research analyst in Washington, a number cruncher. Heard about all this nefarious group that Donovan ran that hired all kinds of high class, the white shoe guys from the best of society. He talked them into letting him join the agency, and eventually, at the young age of 31, was heading up secret intelligence operations for Europe.
Well, let's go through one at a time. Let's start with Alan Dulles. What was his role in World War II?
Dulles ran probably the OSS's most successful station in Bern, Switzerland. This is neutral Switzerland. It's surrounded by the hostile power, the Axis. He, in effect, set up what amounted to a mini CIA in Bern, Switzerland, not only running espionage operations into Germany, but funding clandestine guerrilla operations in occupied France and Italy, running propaganda operations. He also routinely sent back advice to the Roosevelt administration on how it should be dealing with the Axis. Most of that advice, however, was unsolicited. He was just, giving him his opinion. He recruited some of the best spies the Allies had inside the Third Reich, most notably a guy named Fritz Kolbe, who was in the German Foreign Office that supplied Dulles with something on the order of 1,600 classified German military, political, and intelligence documents.
All right. And of course, in terms of outcome or the impact of his, I mean, you say he probably ran the most successful. Give us a sense of the impact of his mission.
It's complicated, and everything in the intelligence business is complicated. There's no simple answer for anything. He, as I say, he was turned out to be a top flight agent in Switzerland. The British, who were his rivals, eventually recognized that. But it wasn't always the case that the Roosevelt administration paid attention to what the intelligence he was providing, which is something you find in the story of every world leader. So, for example, in the case of Fritz Kolbe, here's a diamond of an agent, you know, top flight, the best you can get inside the German Foreign Office. Well, the first reaction of the British and also of the Pentagon, the War Department, was, is this guy a double agent? Right. Is he a plant? Has he been sent to us to infiltrate into us? So it was almost a year after Dulles had first met up with Kolbe and recruited him before Kolbe's reports started to really make a difference in Washington and be sent directly to Franklin Roosevelt.
All right, tell us now about let's move on. We'll talk about Richard Helms.
Richard Helms first started out working in Washington as a staff person, running, being involved with agent operations into Germany, also working on a planning group, really dreaming up clandestine operations around the world. He also had a couple other odd jobs. One time, Donovan had this unsavory French colonel who was Charles de Gaulle's intelligence chief, brought him to the United States basically to butter him up with a junket. And Helms's job, because he'd worked as a reporter and because he spoke French in civilian life, was to accompany this colonel all around, along with his party, all around the country and show him the sights. So they had an expensive dinner at Antoine's restaurant in New Orleans. In Hollywood, studio moguls hooked him up with prostitutes for the night. And Helms's job, which was basically to keep this out of the American press, he succeeded in it, thankfully for him. Eventually, he ended up at the beginning of 1945 in London working for Casey as an agent handler there, and then finally moved into war-torn Berlin just after the war to set up the OSS operation there in Berlin. Very dangerous, unstable mission. I mean, Europe was still in a chaotic, very violent state after the war, and Berlin was the Wild West. And so Helms was not only spying to uncover what was left of the Germans, he was also spying on the Russians. He even spied on the French and the Americans in their zones, too.
In the British. Well, I would think
the French and the British.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, is that you've got to be paying attention to our allies, particularly in a city that's going to be divided four ways like that, because you need to understand their intentions, their capabilities. And remember, it's not clear what politically is going to happen to Europe. Will these become communist states? Will they become all of these questions? So, yeah, you're spying on everybody. And that must have been, you know, that kind of a mission, you can imagine, is kind of mind boggling when you this is where Smiley's people comes out of all that. Like, who's the friend and who's the enemy? Mm-hmm. Bill Kolbe, tell us about Kolbe.
Kolbe trained for a highly secret group whose code name was Jedburgh. And its mission was to drop three-man teams, usually consisting of a British, French, and American officer, into occupied France just after D-Day to hook up with the French resistance to launch guerrilla attacks to help the Allied advance through France. His team dropped into the Burgundy region just southeast of Paris to organize a resistance factions there. Turned out to be a very complicated mission because there were multiple French resistance factions, often fighting among themselves as much as they were fighting the Germans. And Kolbe, though he didn't know it at the time, was dealing with one of the leaders of the French resistance who turned out to be a turncoat, a traitor, collaborating secretly with the Germans. After that mission ended, Kolbe next led a commando team into German-occupied Norway. In March 1945, again, an extremely hazardous mission. He ended up fighting Norway's brutal weather as much as he did the Germans. The combat was very, very dangerous. The skiing was absolutely grueling. One time, in order to escape a Nazi patrol, they had to climb ski up a mountain that they nicknamed Benzedrine Hill because all the skiers had to swallow the artificial stimulants to get up to its peak.
Now, I want to move on to Bill Casey, because then we're going to talk about their roles as CIA directors. And I know time is short, but give us a brief sketch of William Casey's role.
Casey, as one of the OSS officers said, was a guy you could not pay attention to. He was like a human tornado. Donovan eventually sent him to the OSS's very important London station during the war, where at the end of 1944, he made him chief of secret intelligence for all of Europe, with the mission of penetrating Nazi Germany with agents as the Allies advanced into it. A very daunting mission, because even though Germany was losing the war at this point, it still was one of the most tightly controlled police states in the world. I mean, the average German citizen had to have on him 18 different basic identity documents, which Colby's team had to learn how to forge. So it was highly risky missions that they pulled off in the final months of the war.
You point out in the book that none of these individuals by themselves, you know, sort of altered the outcome of the war, but they all played key roles and, again, were advancing, creating, really, the American intelligence service as we know it now. The OSS would become the CIA. The four men you mentioned, not Donovan, but the other four who worked for him would become CIA directors. I'm going to give a brief sketch of what happened afterwards in their careers as director. Alan Dulles essentially, you know, was a big fan of covert operations and responsible for what would ultimately be known as the Bay of Pigs, a catastrophic failure. Richard Helms engineered CIA's effort to oust the democratically elected president of Chile, Salvador Allende. This is a horrific scandal and blight on the record of the United States of America. Bill Colby actually released information about the CIA to Congress, and that did not make him a favorite among CIA operatives. And Bill Casey, of course, responsible in large part for what we now call the Iran-Contra scandal. So ultimately, these guys worked their way up in the agency and led to scandal one way or another. Is there a connection? Is there something about sort of those first days in World War II and then trying to apply those tactics during something as ambiguous as the Cold War?
Well, there are connections. There's also disconnects as much. I mean, history is never a kind of an even straight line, and particularly historical biographies aren't. But you had, with these four men, they left World War II rather invigorated by their war. You know, you don't find PTSD among these guys. They were eager now to fight the next enemy, which was communism, largely how they fought Nazism in the past. In Dulles' case, he believed that men of affairs, which he certainly was a part of, could conduct clandestine wars overseas and cut corners, ethical or legal corners, for a higher cause. Bill Casey, for example, when he became CIA director, hung two photos in his office on the seventh floor of the Langley headquarters. One was of Ronald Reagan, and the other one was of his mentor, Wild Bill Donovan. He basically ran the CIA as he thought Donovan would. Richard Helms, who was somewhat of a skeptic of Donovan, nevertheless believed he was a charismatic leader, and he ran the CIA, very often playing favorites with the old OSS crowd that was in there, which initially infused a lot of esprit de corps and elan in the organization, but it also brought with it from World War II a lot of the delusions that covert operations could solve everything, or that you could cut ethical corners. Bill Colby, who liked to wear his floppy fatigue hat from World War II when he tended his gardens after the war, entered law school and eventually became bored with it and went back into the CIA as a covert warrior. And, you know, the OSS had a huge impact on his life. Richard Helms, I think I've already mentioned, I mean, he, you know, had a, you know, he ran the OSS, I mean, the CIA, with a lot of his OSS favorites in it.
Yeah, well, that's great stuff. Fascinating book, and I wish we had more time. Doug Waller, the author of Disciples, the World War II Missions of the CIA Directors Who Fought for Wild Bill Donovan. Thank you so much, Doug.
Good to be here.
You want more information about the book? Take a look at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Lady and the Tramps on the State of Things. It's live. Stay with us.